Wisdom is knowing the right thing to do or say and knowing the right time to do or say it. If our timing is off, we limit the impact of our good intentions. This is true in every aspect of our lives, including our participation with God in His plans and purposes. Welcome to the GBC Sermon Podcast, a weekly message from Gamia Baptist Church in Sydney, Australia. I'm Mark Rader, Senior Pastor here at GBC, and I'm excited about what the Holy Spirit will do in your life as you listen to this message. As a community of faith, we're passionate about helping people hear and respond to the invitation of God in their life and join in His mission to restore everything in Jesus. In today's message, we explore the lesson of timing from three episodes in Moses' life.
The Bible reading tonight is from Exodus chapter 2, starting at verse 11 and going through to 25. One day, after Moses had grown up, he went out to where his own people were and watched them at their hard labor. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. Looking this way and that, and seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. The next day he went out and saw two Hebrews fighting. He asked the one in the wrong, "Why are you hitting your fellow Hebrew?" The man said, "Who made you ruler and judge over us? Are you thinking of killing me as you killed the Egyptian?" Then Moses was afraid and thought, "What I did must have become known." When Pharaoh heard of this, he tried to kill Moses. But Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in Midian, where he sat down by a well. Now a priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came to draw water and fill the troughs to water their father's flock. Some shepherds came along and drove them away, but Moses got up and came to their rescue and watered their flock. When the girls returned to Reuel, their father, he asked them, "Why have you returned so early today?" They answered, "An Egyptian rescued us from the shepherds. He even drew water for us and watered the flock." "And where is he?" Reuel asked his daughters. "Why did you leave him? Invite him to have something to eat." Moses agreed to stay with the man who gave his daughter Zipporah to Moses in marriage. Zipporah gave birth to a son, and Moses named him Gershon, saying, "I have become a foreigner in a foreign land." During that long period, the king of Egypt died. The Israelites groaned in their slavery and cried out, and their cry for help because of their slavery went up to God. God heard their groaning, and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them.
Thanks, Nicolai. Good evening. It's good to have you with us tonight, and trust you've been encouraged in worship and encouraged in some of the stories that we've heard to keep your own eyes open to see what God might be doing in your own life and in the life of those around you. If you do have your Bibles, you might want to just kind of keep them open to this passage. We're going to have a bit of a look at this passage in just a moment as we continue this series in the book of Exodus. The narrator in Exodus is moving really, really quickly. If you've been following this series along, you might have noticed this. The book opens in chapter 1 by telling us that 70 descendants of Jacob, who was himself a descendant of Isaac and descendant of Abraham and therefore an heir to those promises, 70 of them have entered into Egypt. In just a couple of sentences, they've multiplied exponentially and become an enormous nation that has proved to create an internal policy problem for Pharaoh. And so Pharaoh decides that he's going to deal with them in a particular way, and his actions also escalate really, really quickly in the text. In one sentence, they have enslaved the people of Israel, and in another couple of sentences, they have introduced a pogrom where they are killing male babies. And just when things seem to be as dark as they can possibly get, a child is born in somewhat unusual circumstances. Well, actually the circumstances of their birth are fairly normal, but what happens immediately after their birth becomes quite remarkable. It's the birth of Moses, which we looked at in the last section of this text. But between verse 10 of chapter 2 and verse 11 of chapter 2, there's a 40-year gap, and there's another 40 years before we open chapter 3 when the story actually really begins to slow down. And in those 80 years, there are only a handful of things that the narrator thinks it's important for us to know about Moses' life. So this is 80 years. Here's the 80-year summary after his kind of miraculous rescue from the Nile River. He kills an Egyptian one day, breaks up a fight the next, meets seven daughters a few days later after that, gets married, has a kid. That's the lot. In fact, those first three events take place on one day, the next day, and as long as it takes to get from Egypt to Midian. So probably 1 week of Moses' life. And as far as the narrator is concerned, it contains everything that we need to know about his life. So be careful what happens to you this week because it might summarize your entire life. So Moses, these events kind of point to something quite significant for us. And we have to try to figure out what that is. I'm always a little bit hesitant when people try to build personality profiles or character profiles of a biblical character based on just a handful of stories, as if we have enough information to do that. But these passages have been given to us for a particular reason. And when I was looking at them, when I was kind of thinking about them this week, what struck me most, what stood out to me as I was looking at these verses was what a stark contrast they are to the first part of chapter 2. See, in both sections, in verses 1 to 10 and then verses 11 to 22, where the bulk of the story takes place, God is not mentioned, right? So the first mention of God is actually in verses 23, 24, and 25. And that takes place after Pharaoh dies and a long time later. But the stories themselves, from Moses' birth and his miraculous rescue, all the way through these three little episodes, his marriage and the birth of his child, all that takes place without reference to God. And yet, as we saw last week, I think the fingerprints of God are all over his birth and those opening kind of scenes of his life. Right? Not to kind of preach last week's sermon again, but let me just remind you. The narrator gives us a couple of clues in the language that they use to kind of give a nod to the fact that God's probably at work. The language that reminds us of the purpose and the good of creation. The language that reminds us of Noah and his ark because Moses is placed in a papyrus ark rather than just a basket. Then we have that remarkable timing of Pharaoh's daughter coming down to the water to be the first to find the child. And of all the people to have compassion on a Hebrew child, the only person we would find less likely would have been Pharaoh himself. Her heart seems to be changed within her. Then you have Miriam's super quick, lightning fast reflexes in coming forward. And then the delightful irony, of course, of Pharaoh's daughter saying to Moses' mother, "Would you please raise this child that I just found and I will pay you to do it." Like, it's just delightful. And we see God's fingerprints all over the story. And then we look in verse 11 to 22. And I don't see God here at all. I don't see any of those coincidences in these verses. I don't see any of those incidences where you think to yourself, yeah, that sounds a little bit like God. That's unusual. That's interesting or that's strange, and surely God's at work in that. I have a hard time seeing him here. And what made that contrast kind of all the stranger is that Moses here appears to be acting in line with God's promises and with the values of the law that will become clearer as the book of Exodus unfolds. I mean, have a look again at what it is that Moses does, right? He's grown up and he goes out to see his people. He's watching them in their hard labor and he sees an Egyptian beating a Hebrew. Now, we assume because of the context that this is a slave master and a slave. It doesn't actually say that it is. This might have just been any general oppression. And we're also not told how Moses felt, but we assume that there was some sort of righteous anger at the mistreatment of his people. We don't know if Moses thought about the promises of God and how God was going to save us, but we'd have no idea about any of the motivation. But but what comes out of it is that he murders this Egyptian in an attempt to try to do, I guess, the right thing by his people. And there's a whole bunch of weird stuff about the murder, right? First of all, it's never mentioned again, which seems strange to me. When God calls Moses at the burning bush, he doesn't say, listen, I'm sending you on a really important task, but we have to talk about that incident. You know what I mean. God never raises it. The people of Israel never raise it. It never gets mentioned again, which is, I think, a little bit strange given the kind of act that it is. It's also interesting to note that what we find here is a little bit of a parallel storyline, that an Egyptian is killed, and then Moses has to flee from Egypt. And in a few chapters, we'll find that lots of Egyptians are killed and Israel has to leave Egypt. So there's this kind of parallel foreshadowing thing going on in this story as well. But apart from that, what I find most striking about Moses' actions is how little they accomplish. It doesn't actually make any difference at all, apart from the life of that Egyptian. But it doesn't mean that the Hebrew who was being beaten will not be beaten again tomorrow. He hasn't undone slavery. He hasn't undone their hardship. He hasn't started a rebellion or a revolution or begun to gather a cadre of other like-minded people to begin that process. Absolutely nothing happens apart from Moses having to flee the country, which seems strange. Well, the next day he goes out and he sees a couple of Hebrews fighting with each other. And again, we're not told the motivation, but it seems that he wants to bring about some sort of justice. He wants to see justice and reconciliation and the right things done, which lines up with the sorts of things that God would be concerned with, isn't it? And yet, when he actually breaks the fight up and says to the one in the wrong, why are you hitting your fellow Hebrew? The man basically responds by going, who died and made you king? And speaking of dying, are you just going to murder me like you murdered the Egyptian the other day? Like, it goes really badly for Moses. He tries to do the right thing. He tries to bring justice and reconciliation, and his authority to do so is rejected and undermined. If you kind of jump way ahead into the book of Acts, in Acts chapter 7, Stephen, in one of his, well, in his speech defending himself, he actually draws on this story as one example of many where the people of Israel reject the people that God had sent. And here we find Moses trying to do something that sounds like the right thing, but nothing comes of it. I mean, the way the story reads, it sounds like they're fighting each other. Moses breaks it up and says, why are you doing that? And the guy says, who died and made you king? And they go back at it. Like, he hasn't even solved this problem. And then he finds out, of course, that the murder has been known, and so off he runs to Midian. Sits down at a well and meets these seven shepherding sisters who suffer systemic bullying, right? And notice how their dad was surprised they got home early on that one day. He's used to them not being there early. They take their flocks to a watering hole, to a well. These were obviously very important sites where lots of shepherds would bring their flocks and herds. Apparently, these seven young women simply couldn't kind of force their way to the water. And so they arrive there, these other shepherds drive them away, but this time it's different because Moses is there and he rises up and he comes to their rescue. It's pretty strong language, isn't it? He rises to their rescue. He beats them all back, he waters the flock, the whole bit makes a big difference. And again, notice what he's doing. He is serving those and helping those who are oppressed and have no influence and no power. That sounds like the sorts of things that God's concerned about, doesn't it? And yet, once again, the story ends really weirdly. Because after he rescues these seven women and waters their flocks and herds, they leave him at the well. Thanks, see ya. And when they get home and their dad says, why are you home so early? They say, oh, an Egyptian, he's not an Egyptian, they misrepresent him, an Egyptian rescued us. And Reuel, later we find out his name is also Jethro, he says, well, where is he, girls? Like, chop, chop, back to the well and pick the boy up. Like, bring him home. And so Moses seems to have been overlooked in terms of even the gratitude that you might normally expect. Now, he ends up marrying one of the daughters, and he ends up having a son who he basically names, not from around here. Thanks, Dad, great name. As a reminder of the fact that he is a foreigner in a foreign land. But all of these stories combined all together raised for me a really significant question. Why is it that Moses' actions, which seemed to be in line with the promises of God, which seemed to be in line with the kinds of values that God would espouse, the things that we're going to hear about in the law, particularly caring for the marginalized and oppressed, how can it be that Moses can act in those sorts of ways and have next to nothing happen? Like almost nothing good happens. It's just kind of this strange placeholder until we get to chapter 3. In fact, we could have really just skipped all of chapter 2, verses 11 to 25. The narrator could have said, and Moses grew up, and long story short, he was in the wilderness and there was a bush. And we wouldn't have missed anything. Moses has done these things, and there's been absolutely no effect. So that got me thinking. What's going on here? And I reckon that there might be a bit of a clue for us in how the passage opens and how it concludes. I mentioned that it concludes by talking about God. I want you to notice one of the kind of the pieces within this. So in verse 11 and 12 and 13, we have a couple of key words that occur. One is wrapped around seeing. It's just the normal kind of verb for to see. And there's a verb about knowing, to know. We don't notice it as much because in English translations, we don't like to use the same words several times in a row. We like variation, and so we use synonyms and whatnot. But five times, Moses sees something. So he goes out and watches his people at their hard labor, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew. He looked this way and that, and seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian. And the next day, he saw for a fifth time. He sees the injustice, he sees the fight, and he sees the oppression. And the only thing that becomes known out of this is his murder leading to his own exile. Fast forward to the end of the story. Because at the end of the story, we're told that the king of Egypt died, the Israelites groaned in their slavery, and their cry because of their slavery comes up to God, who hears, and he remembers his covenant. Right? I'll come back to that in a moment. And he looked on them, he saw the Israelites, and he knew them. He knew their oppression. Now, when it says that God remembered, it doesn't mean that God had actually been distracted for 80 years, as if God had just kind of forgotten what had taken place, like we might forget things. When it talks about God remembering, it's a call to act. When God remembers, he begins to do something. And here seemed to me to be the place where we had a bit of a clue and an indicator about what was going on here. Moses sees and he acts. And what becomes known is simply the murder. When God sees and God begins to act, things really begin to change. And I thought to myself, I wonder if what's taking place here is that Moses's timing was off. See, timing is a really critical part of wisdom. Wisdom is made up of two pieces, right? You've got to know the right thing to say and to do, and you have to get your timing right. If you say or do the right thing at the wrong time, that's not wisdom, right? It ends as badly as if you'd said or done the wrong thing anyways. You need to understand what to do and when to do it. And there's been a bit of a sub-theme all the way through the text. So when the people of Israel have multiplied, Pharaoh says to his people, we must deal wisely with the people of Israel. And his actions betray the fact that he has no idea about what real wisdom looks like because of the way he treats the people of God. And then we find the story of the midwives tucked away in chapter 1. When they fear God more than they feared Pharaoh, and they are blessed because of their timing and their actions in the midst of it. And Moses' mother seems to have had some pretty good timing herself when she placed the ark in the Nile River and all of those things. And here Moses seems to know the right thing to do. He seems to know the right thing to do. He seems to know the right places that he needs to act, but his timing is off. Every so often with Bible passages, I like to ask the question, what would have happened if something had changed in the story? It's a bit of a, you know, just a flight of fancy, really. But what would have happened, do you think? If after verse 11, when Moses saw his people at their hard labor, and after he had witnessed this Egyptian beating this Hebrew, one of his own people, what would have happened if instead of looking this way and that and killing the Egyptian, what if he had gone home to his room in the palace and had fallen on his knees and said, O Lord, God of my fathers, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God who made these extraordinary promises to make us a great nation, to rescue us from Egypt and bring us back to that land. O God, where are you? You've been faithful and you've made us a nation, but where's the next stage of the promise? When are you going to do something about this? When are you going to stop the oppression? When are you going to step in and make this right? And while we're on it, what the heck am I doing in the palace? Why of all my people, of all the people of Israel scattered across Egypt, why was it myself that was plucked from the Nile River? Why was I brought into Pharaoh's palace? Why have I been educated and trained and equipped and prepared? I have no idea what you want me to do. Oh God, when are you going to act and when are you going to use me? I wonder what would have happened. Now, there's no right answer, of course, because it's just making things up. But I do wonder if the deliverance of God might have come just a little bit quicker. If instead of just acting on his own, out of his own passion and out of the need that he saw, if Moses had actually looked to see what God was doing, things might have moved a little bit quicker. You see, when we act out of passion, as Moses appears to have done, or when we act out of a need that we encounter, as again Moses seems to have done, when we act only out of passion and only out of need, we end up doing some good things, but the impact is not nearly as significant as if we were to take our passion and the needs that we see in our world and engage with them and align those things with what God is doing. Because when we take our passion and we align it with what God is doing to meet a need, the impact of our words and our actions are amplified. They're magnified, they're increased, and they become enormous opportunities for transformation in the world around us. And so the invitation that came out of this passage for me, the invitation from the example of Moses' life in this patch, the invitation seems to me to not only take steps of courageous faith. You know, last week I encouraged us that we have to act like God's already at work. We have to be looking for where God might be at work and stepping out in faith. We can't wait until we have absolute certainty to step out in faith, because that undermines the whole process of having faith in the first place. But we can't also just step out blindly whenever we have some sort of rise within our spirit. We can't just step out blindly whenever there's a need in front of us. We also have to step out when we discern and hear the voice of God. So the invitation to myself and hopefully for each one of you is, are you listening closely to what God is doing? Are you asking God to attune your heart, to open your eyes and your ears, so that when the gentle whisper of the Holy Spirit just breezes past you, you might pick it up and begin to move in the same direction? When the gentle current of the Spirit of God begins to move in your life, to move you in a particular direction, are you sensitive enough to actually pick that up and begin to move with God? So that we don't end up doing these fantastic things out of a great motivation and a wonderful heart and fine intentions and lots of passion to meet a great need, but we do it without God. Because when we do things with God, when we do things with God, when we are listening, when we are attuned, when our eyes are on Him, when our ears are open for Him, when our hearts are soft to His movement, then we have the opportunity to have a maximum impact in the world in which we live. Moses' experience here, these experiences of acting in line with the promises of God, these activities that seem to be about justice and seem to be about helping the oppressed and working with the marginalized, all the good stuff seems to have kind of lost its maximum impact because Moses was not, at this point in time, looking to or asking for the guidance of God. And in chapter 3, when God calls Moses, things begin to change. Because all of a sudden, God and Moses are working together. There's an alignment of purpose. There's an alignment of passion to meet the need. And some amazing things happen when that takes place. So as you look for the hand of God in your life, as you listen for his activity, as you consider how you are invited into that, can I encourage you to make part of your prayer this week, God, can you show me where you're at work? You know, I wonder sometimes, and we've been asking this question a little while now about, you know, where have you seen God at work? But until that becomes something that we're asking every day, I'm not sure how often we're going to see it. If the only time you think of that question is when you get to church and it's about, I don't know, 20 past six, and whoever gets up and leads the service and says, oh, where have you seen God at work? And you go, oh, right. Where was God at work? Think. I can't think of anything. But if we make that our prayer every single day, if we make it our prayer every single day, God, show me, open my eyes, soften my heart, open my ears so that I can discern and hear you so that I can do what you're doing. If we can begin to do that, the impact of our actions and our words and the lives of those around us will be amplified and magnified to eternity. So there's your challenge, to pay more attention to the things of God so that you can see God's hand at work.
I trust you've been encouraged to step out in faith while keeping an eye on God's activity, and that you see the amplified impact of going with God, not just with passion or a need this week. We'd love to hear from you about your adventures in following Jesus. You can find us on Facebook or visit our website at gaimiabaptist.org.au. We hope you join us again as we listen for God's invitation to join in his work. And just a reminder that this series will be broadcast on ACC TV later this year. And you can follow New Horizons TV on Mondays at 10 p.m. or Thursdays at 8:30 and watch previous sermons on our website. May you have the courage to join in with God where he invites you this week. God bless.